This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and five focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. Today, I'm going to take you back in time. We'll still be in Chicago in the Gold Coast neighborhood, but back in the mid-20th century.
In the 50s and 60s, and of course, I'm not talking from personal experience, but the Newberry neighborhood, also known as the Near North Side or the Gold Coast, was considered to be the Las Vegas of the Midwest.
This is Allison Hinderleiter. She's a librarian at the Newberry Library.
So you have the Newberry Library, which has been around since 1887, and it's a rare books independent research library. So it was a little bit academic and scholarly, but then just two blocks east was Rush Street, which was neon signs and nightclubs, restaurants, bars, all sorts of entertainment and nightlife. It was really just sort of an adult Disney world.
And there was one particular nightclub in the area that stood out. It was an intimate venue called Mr. Kelly's. And there were some big names that came through this place.
And now Mr. Kelly's takes great pleasure in presenting Mercury recording artist, the divine Sarah Vaughan.
The leaves of brown came tumbling down, remember.
This is Sarah Vaughan singing live at Mr. Kelly's in 1957.
In the rain.
And this is Ella Fitzgerald at Mr. Kelly's in 1958.
Summertime. And the living.
I mean, I could name drop so many other famous acts that came through here. Singers like Barbara Streisand, Della Reese. Comedians like Richard Pryor, Joan Rivers, Lily Tomlin. There's so many more. Some people would say that if Jerry Stiller wasn't able to make a living at Mr. Kelly's, there would be no Ben Stiller. The club closed in 1975, but right now at the Newberry Library, there's an exhibit all about it. It features photos and music and old menus and a trip through the neighborhood as it was when Mr. Kelly's was in its prime. The exhibit is open through July 20th. Allison showed me around a few weeks ago, and then we sat down with David Marienthal. He produced a documentary film called Live at Mr. Kelly's a few years ago. David is also the son of one of the former owners of Mr. Kelly's, George Marienthal, so he grew up at the club, for better or for worse. They're both going to tell me about the star-studded history of Mr. Kelly's and the economic conditions that led to it eventually closing. David, I know that, you know, you grew up kind of in this space. You came along. I know your dad was in his 40s, right, when you came along?
Yeah, my dad was 41 when I was born, so he had already been well-established with the London House, which was his first club, that was right across from the Wrigley Building.
Right.
But, you know, as I got older, I definitely spent time with my father at the clubs. My mother would dress us up in sweaters and comb our hair back every Sunday to go to the London House, which was a jazz club. So I was able to see greats like Oscar Peterson, Errol Garner, George Shearing. And so that was a thrill, being the boss's son, and the employees would call my father Mr. George, and so they'd call me Mr. David. It was really the employees and the staff. It was really like a family. So yeah. It was really, really special. And then I would go in on Saturdays with my father to work, and I'd get to play on the adding machines, and he'd give me little jobs like scraping the gum from under the tables. And and I'd go down to the bakery and sample all the goods. So it was a lot of fun.
Make sure they taste proper.
Exactly.
That's an important job.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I grew up, my mother is a barber, and I grew up going to work with her too every day after school, basically. So I know that kind of family feel that can happen at your parents' job for sure. So Allison, tell me, how did Mr. Kelly start? David talked about the London House. This was another venture that the Marienthal brothers started. How did it get going?
Well, the Marienthal brothers had a real success with London House. It was their first venture together, George and Oscar, the brothers Marienthal. And so they wanted to get a little bit of the action that was happening on Rush Street. So they opened up Mr. Kelly's at right at the where Rush and State Street meet at Bellevue Place. It's where Gibson's Steakhouse is now. And it had been a coffee shop. And for a short time, it was a restaurant called Al Nemitz. And then they took over the building since they had such success with the London House being a steakhouse. Mr. Kelly's was also a steakhouse with cocktails.
And Mr. Kelly himself.
And Mr. Kelly himself, who was a maitre d' when they first opened, but he was fired soon after that.
Okay.
They decided to keep the name. And there's David could probably tell a few stories about maybe why, because nobody knows for sure why. But I was doing research and finding early ads for Mr. Kelly's that billed itself as an Irish pub. So it makes sense that they would keep the name Mr. Kelly's if that was their angle to be an Irish style pub.
Because Kelly is an Irish name.
Because Kelly's is an Irish name. Yeah.
David. Yeah. Get in there. What anecdotes do you have for us there?
You know, we had always heard that, again, that it was named after Pat Kelly, who was a manager, maitre d', when they started. And at one point, I thought they even fired him before they even opened.
Wow.
But Allison in the Newberry found out that maybe they were thinking of an Irish pub type theme, which, you know, worked very well with two Jewish brothers opening a club in Mayor Daley's Chicago. With the Irish police force and everything that went in with that. So they definitely had to work within the structure that was there.
And look, they built a little empire.
They were hugely successful, too. I mean, the evidence is there. They really thought strategically about their success. I mean, just the placement of the London House at Michigan and Wacker, just across the river from both the Sun-Times and Daily News building and the Tribune building, ensured that reporters would come and enjoy a steak and enjoy some jazz and then further promote and write about what was happening at London House.
Yeah.
And they were extremely successful.
Yeah. Yeah, I was impressed walking through the exhibit, just seeing all of the obviously different names that showed up, but also the marketing and the way that they set it up. David, do you remember being in Mr. Kelly's, the OG, the original? Tell me, like, what was the scene like? What did it look and feel like in there?
Well, as a young, you know, below teenage years, Mr. Kelly's was seen as more of an adult nightclub
okay.
in London. So we would go there occasionally when something was really special. And one of those occasions was Barbara Streisand making her first Chicago appearance. She came in, and I remember going down with my father and mother. You've got to see this. And when she came on, I was 12, and she didn't really look that much older than I was. And she was 20, I guess, and kind of a modest-looking young lady. And she had the sailor suit, the thing that she used to wear. So you really didn't know what to expect when she opened her mouth. You just really, I think everybody just knew you were in the presence of genius and the show that she put on. So that was certainly one thing about Kelly's.
Allison, what are some of the kind of descriptions that you've read of the inside of and the kind of the feel and the culture at Mr. Kelly's?
The word that comes up almost all the time is intimate because it was, I think, 200 seats, right, David, or seats 200.
Yeah, about that.
And the tables for dining were right butted up against the stage. And there's this wonderful photo of Eartha Kitt on the stage when she appeared there in 62, and she's reclining and basically touching the hair of a patron who is sitting there at a table. It was that close.
Wow.
So it just must have been thrilling, especially if you were a fan of Sarah Vaughan or of Eartha Kitt, or you're watching Richard Pryor for the first time, and they're right in front of you. I mean, there's basically no space between the audience and the entertainer.
Yeah.
And entertainers loved it too. Bob Newhart was interviewed, and he mentioned that it was a great room for comics, because if you have a large hall with high ceilings, it's kind of death to a stand-up comedian, because the laughs just kind of go straight up to the ceiling. And here you had that interaction, whether it was people loving you or hecklers, it was right there.
Yeah.
And the comedians that worked that room really loved it.
In my imagination, this is like Rihanna or like Kevin Hart, just like at the Promontory.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
very similar.
I just cannot imagine that. And I can't imagine that it would ever happen today. And I wonder what you would say about how things were back then that would make that something like that possible.
Yeah. Well, the thing was that entertainers who were brought in were usually brought in for about 1 to 3 weeks at a time. So it wasn't just a one night stand like people do and then move on to a different city.
Interesting.
And they were paid extremely well. So there were established stars, like somebody like Ella Fitzgerald, who was just paid and treated extremely well. And the entertainers loved that. But even the up and comers like Bob Newhart, he had made a name for himself by doing his comedy record, but he was a Chicago kid, and he considered Mr. Kelly's to be sort of the pinnacle of his career. Like, if you can play Kelly's, you can play anywhere. And he was pleasantly surprised by how much he was paid. So that was just a different way of doing things in the 50s, 60s. And then in the 70s, it started to drop off because the whole culture changed. And there's a quote from Ramsey Lewis, who was the house band at London House for a very long time. But he said towards the end, he was getting more and more festival gigs, and he couldn't really clear time in his calendar for a 3-week stint.
Yeah.
And I think that was true of a lot of entertainers. And it was just venues were getting bigger. There were more festivals. There were more opportunities. Because in the 50s, stand-up comedy was still a really new thing. There were no comedy clubs.
Okay, so tell me, because I know at Mr. Kelly's, it was just jazz at first, right?
It started out as just jazz.
Yeah. How did the comedy component come into play there?
I'm not quite sure. I don't know if David knows.
Originally, they did open Mr. Kelly's for a couple of years just as a bar and grill.
Okay.
Then they started to bring in music. And then, but very shortly after, they did come up with this motif of a stand-up comedian and a jazz vocalist.
Okay.
So, again, in terms of the atmosphere, you'd walk in, the maitre d' would seat you, then your waiter would come over, you'd order dinner and cocktails. And during that time, there was a jazz trio playing, which was a world-class jazz trio. And then once most patrons, finish their dinner, they'd have the opening act. Again, it might be Woody Allen opening up for Ella Fitzgerald.
Okay.
Or Lainey Kazan opening up for Richard Pryor.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? I can't even imagine. I mean, you were there. I can't even imagine this.
Yeah. It sounds like a dream.
Yeah. It sounds like a dream. I know that the civil rights movement was happening also during Mr. Kelly's prime. And one of the first black comedians to cross over from what was then called the Chitlin Circuit into mainstream stages was Dick Gregory, if not the first. And this happened at the Playboy Club and at Mr. Kelly's. And I'm just wondering, what do you think it was about your family's sensibilities, David, that made them create a safe space for performers and patrons from all backgrounds during that time?
You know, it was really a combination of things. And I don't really want to deify my father and uncle in terms of, you know, their contribution to the civil rights movement.
Okay.
I feel like they, you know, believed in treating people fairly. You know, they'd both grown up in the city and they knew all types of people and they'd worked together. The connection between the Jewish community and the African-American community was always interwoven. But I do think, you know, they were sensitive to, you know, pushing boundaries. It was a magic, again, because they'd have conventioneers coming from all over the Midwest and very conservative people, and they'd have these other sophisticated people, and they, you know, and they'd welcome people of all races.
Yeah. Allison, as you gave us a tour, I was so excited to see Tim and Tom.
Oh, yes.
Tim Reed, a comedian that people may know as the dad from Sister Sister, and Tom Dreesen, another comic who was later a regular on Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about their act and how that also kind of pushed the envelope.
Yes, that it's one of my favorite stories to tell when I give tours. But Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, both came from very impoverished backgrounds. So Tim Reed was raised in Norfolk, Virginia area. Tom Dreesen from Harvey, Illinois. And
Tim was black, Tom was white.
Exactly. Tim was black. Still is.
Is black.
Tom Dreesen is still white.
Is still white. yes.
They met when they both moved to Chicago for work, and they both came from backgrounds where parents were very addicted to alcohol and drugs. And so they were both very interested in educating youth about the harms of drugs. Mm. And this was before, you know, the Reagan, you know, just say no period. This was in the mid 60s. Anyway, the two of them teamed up and went to schools and started talking about the dangers of doing drugs. And they went to one school and a eighth grade girl said to them, "You two are so funny together," because they used humor to get the point across. "You two should be a comedy team."
Oh.
And they looked at each other and kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, "Okay, that sounds like a great idea." So the two of them were active from the late 60s to the early 70s together as Tim and Tom. They toured all over. They toured universities. They performed in predominantly black clubs and predominantly white clubs. And if you think of the time period, 1969, 1970, it was after the assassination of Dr. King. There were race riots. There was so much racial tension. And here you have a young black man and a young white man standing together on stage together at a time period when you probably wouldn't even see them walking down the street together normally. And as Tim Reed describes it, the first 15 seconds were always of total silence in the club. People were just looking up at them going, what's going to happen next? But they broke the ice. And they did their routines and won the audience over most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote a very entertaining book called Tim and Tom, Comedy in Black and White, where they talk about all of their experiences. I would highly recommend this book. You can get it digitally or you can buy it from the Newberry Library Bookshop. It's out of print, so you can't find it anywhere else. Anyway, they struggled, though. I mean, they played Mr. Kelly's. They opened for Della Reese. And both of them also performed solo at Mr. Kelly's at different times. They are still friends, but they stopped being a comedy team around 1974 when they realized that it just wasn't making them enough money. And so, but they both went on to really stellar careers, as you mentioned, Tim, in television. And I remember him. I'm from an earlier generation. I remember him from WKRP in Cincinnati, where he was Venus Flytrap, the coolest DJ ever on Cincinnati radio. But Tom Dreesen, as you mentioned, did stand-up comedy, did The Tonight Show, and he also opened for Sammy Davis Jr. He opened for Smokey Robinson.
Wow.
And the last 13 years of Frank Sinatra's career, he opened for Sinatra. And he also has a very good memoir out called Still Standing.
Okay. Nice. This place, Mr. Kelly's, was such an icon. It was such a staple. All of these iconic artists recorded their first albums there. Mm-hmm. Singers sang both at and about Mr. Kelly's.
That's
I remember
right.
seeing a Billie Holiday song where she's singing about Mr. Kelly's. Why do you think people don't talk about it as much anymore?
That's a good question, because the live recordings at Mr. Kelly's, Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Anita O'Day, they do talk about Mr. Kelly's there, and it's they're well-known recordings among jazz fans. But I think perhaps it might be still a Midwestern bias where they're overshadowed by the jazz clubs that were in New York wow. and in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And anybody who's in Chicago remembers Mr. Kelly's if they're of a certain age, which is exciting. Part of what we're trying to do at the Newbery is to make it better known to a new generation. What we're trying to do is kind of recreate the experience,
mm-hmm.
of course, without the booze and cigarette smoke, but recreate the feeling of being in an intimate club, of seeing these wonderful stars. It's very special to me that it's also at a time period when a lot of people remember going.
Yeah.
Whether they were young and they went
yes.
for prom, or they borrowed their older siblings' fake ID or real ID and got in. And we're creating a space for people to leave their memories. I'm continuing the oral history project because we want to capture as many memories of that as possible.
Yeah. Allison Hinderleiter is the curator of the exhibit, A Night at Mr. Kelly's at the Newbery Library. Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Marienthal is the executive producer of the documentary from 2021, Live at Mr. Kelly's. He's also the son of the co-owner of Mr. Kelly's, George Marienthal. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Erin. It's been a real pleasure to go through these stories and memories with you and Allison again. So I enjoyed it.
A Night at Mr. Kelly's is free and open to the public through July 20th at the Newbery Library. You can get more info in the show notes to this episode or at newbery.org. And that's it for today. Justin Bull, Sarah Stark, and I produce The Rundown. Ariel Van Cleve is our editor and executive producer. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you love the show, rate us, review us. It helps more people find the show. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening to The Rundown. I'll talk to you tomorrow.